Welcome to Combox, the Wagon Wheel show here where I, Jared Kimber, answer many, many questions on cricket that can be random and everything else. If you are on YouTube at the moment, the best way to ask them is via the Super Chat function. But if you're not on YouTube at the moment, then you can't ask them on that. That's just how these things work, as far as I understand. But that's why a lot of people support us on Patreon. They get Good Areas podcasts, and they support us over there. And there, they ask the questions beforehand. That's how it works. Some questions now, some questions before. But we start with the before questions. I hope I've explained the concept of what is a really simple show in the most complicated way possible. Yeah. Anyway, Chris says, can you explain to me why Ben Sears had zero cut through in the last England Test match? Feels like his action leaves too much room for error and wayward lines when bowling. Yeah, I think he's probably someone who slides on to the bat a little bit more. And that was a bizarre surface, right? Like it was, what, almost 2 days of the best batting surface that you will come across. And then it became a surface where I suppose line and length was the most important thing. But I think specifically hitting the surface. And his ball sort of skid off the surface a little bit. And I don't think he got as much of the inconsistent bounce as everyone else. So if you compare him to Zach Foulkes, like there's nothing in that test match that tells me that Zach Foulkes is going to be a better test match bowler than Chris Smith, you know, going ahead. Like, you know, I didn't look at that at all and think to myself, you know, you're in a situation where this guy is better than the other guy. But in that particular test, Zach Foulkes was an almost perfect weapon, right? His ability to bowl fairly accurately at the top of the stumps with a bit of a weird action. He had the three-quarter seam wobble ball, which can get inconsistent bounce and can seam around. Like there were just so many things that worked really well for him in that situation. So yeah, I think sometimes you just get something like that. I think you're right. I don't think Sears is particularly accurate. I think that's probably a fair assumption based on what we have seen so far of him. But I wouldn't judge him on that last pitch. Ali says, is South Africa the cricket equivalent of France in how much talent it exports outside to other countries too? Wouldn't India have probably of recent times exported the most talent outside of countries? I'm not sure. I suppose it depends on where you want to draw the lines. Like France has won some things as well. I mean, France is very different, right? A lot of theirs is through immigration. So I'm not as much of an expert on the football team, but I know a lot of the football players can play for, like, qualify for at least two teams that they could play for and sometimes three. And if I'm not mistaken, Joel Embiid, did he not qualify for, is he from Congo? Congo, France, and America for when it came to basketball. So you've got these sort of complicated immigration things when it comes to France, which I would say is more probably like England, right, than it is South Africa. So I think it's different if that's what you're talking about. But yeah, lots of talent in South Africa too. Hertz says, we talk a lot about bowlers hunting in pairs or as a pack, but which batting pairs or combination come to your mind where the dynamic makes the sum of the parts greater than their individual contributions? And this is going to sound silly, but one of the most famous ones would have to be Crawley and Duckett, right? Like individually, Duckett's a very good test player, but Crawley clearly isn't. But as a partnership, that kind of made a lot more sense. I'm trying to think of some other ones. I suppose Kumar and Mahela, especially in Sri Lanka, made it really tough. You've got a left-hander who bats, you know, to the conditions every single time. You've got a right-hander who can play almost every available shot to spin. You know, that combination probably is a really famous one. So even though they're both great players, I think the combination probably makes them better. Generally, when you think about batting pairs, you do think about sort of openers, but I'm trying to think of something that's not openers because openers is almost too easy for this. And then you want them to be better as well, don't you? Yeah, those are the ones that I kind of, that instantly come to my mind. I'm not sure I have, everyone else is just openers. It's the same answers that everyone gets, but there would be other versions. I'm trying to think. I always thought that Ponting and Langer or Ponting and Hayden worked really well because it became a left-hand, right-hand combination, but also You know, there's a particular way that you have to bolt to Hayden because of his height and everything. There's a particular length that you have to bolt to Langer. And then Ponting then comes in, and no matter who he partners with, it changes that. So what you really, you know, in general, what you're really looking for is a front foot player to pair with a back foot player, a player of spin to pair with a player of pace. You know, those are the sorts of things you're looking at. And then you can get more out of it because it makes it harder for the opposition to just bowl the same thing. Josh says, pundits analysing the England-New Zealand series talked about how New Zealand won despite having lost several of its pace bowlers during the series. I know that several of them forgot that Duffy stayed home on paternity duty. Going forward, does player of the series, Nathan Smith, make New Zealand's best 11 with Henry and Duffy opening the bowling and Jameson and O'Rourke as change bowlers? I didn't forget Duffy, but yeah, I'm sure some people did. If you're not in the series, these are kind of how these things work sometimes. I think beforehand, I would have said that Henry, Jameson, Duffy were the three main new ball bowlers for me. And I would have had O'Rourke as the first change slash into the wicket bowler. And so that Smith would miss out. I think I did a short video on Smith. We never did a long one just because of the way the series sort of broke. But Smith just kept impressing me. And I now wonder if he doesn't come in ahead of Duffy and he bowls the sort of first change spell, if Henry or Jameson isn't getting any cut through. So that sort of 8-12 over mark. So comes on really, really early. He's a world-class fielder. He can hold the bat. Like, he's got lots of different things available to him. In Australia, I would have thought traditionally Duffy would have been the better bowler, but I could see how Smith could line up in Australia as well. It's good to have choices. Chances are that someone will be injured anyway. Chris says, can you explain to me why Ben... Oh, no, I've already done that. I have explained it, Chris. Neil says, as a Test cricket fan who's only followed the game for the last 15 years, he's transported to watch it in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Does he, she find it boring? I think the 2000s was boring. I say this as someone who made his career in that period. There were just a lot of big scores made, a lot of good bowlers made to look silly because of the pitches. I personally struggled at times with some of those test matches. I don't think you can go back to the 80s and 90s and find it boring. It's slower. Those two decades are different than the one we have now. But in terms of bowlers still having a real say in games, I think you struggle to say that they didn't. And so that, for me, that kept jeopardy. And if you go back to the 80s, you also have the fact that you have a lot of guys still not wearing the helmets or not having a lot of padding. So the bouncer, there's more jeopardy in that as well. If you like spin bowling, I think the 80s is pretty poor. It does disappear a little bit. But yeah, it would be very, very different. And in the same way that modern people, the older people are struggling with how modern test cricket is played, it changes for every generation. The 50s is probably the one that no one wants to go back to. Satchmo says, are there any innovators in the history of cricket who don't get any credit for how they influenced the game? For example, bowlers who were reversing the ball before it came a thing. There's definitely stories of West Indian bowlers bowling reverse swing, but not knowing precisely how it was done. So I can't remember which surfaces it was on, but it was obviously on an abrasive surface where there were times in the West Indies, certainly in first class cricket, where they thought the ball would reverse and it just sort of happened. Then there was the Victorian bowlers who come through in the late 1960s to early 1970s, who again, I think, kind of understood some of the parts of reverse swing, but not exactly how to replicate it the way that the Pakistanis would eventually learn how to do. Again, I think the West Indians and the Victorians, maybe it had more to do with the surfaces and the way it made the ball abrasive, and they couldn't make it happen consistently. There are stories of reverse sweeps going back late 1800s, I would say. I don't know how much I believe all those. There's a Leary story about him playing a scoop over his head. Sounds like to me it was a full toss at his face and he just hit it away. Like, I don't think it was a real scoop. But there are little things like that with Leary that certainly come on board. you know, I think you could say that the West Indians and the county bowlers had as much to do with bodyline bowling as England did. But England did it in a major series, and obviously that's going to get more thought about. Yeah, so there's lots of little things. And, you know, you look at I've done the history of reverse swing, for instance. And Sarfraz Nawaz gets the credit. But actually, he learned it from someone else, right? And so that's generally the way that these things go. The first person to do it really good or in a famous situation is the one who gets remembered for it. You know, even Ryan Campbell and Douglas Murillia don't often get mentioned as much as Tilakar and Dilshan does, right? But the Dil scoop isn't actually as common a shot. The Murillia shot was more common. And even the one that Ryan Campbell plays is probably more a variation of what we have now. PJ says, where next for bad boy Baz? What country would realistically give him a test job? Does he just go back to the golf course and T20 circuit after England? Yeah, I don't think he was ever going to coach another international team after England. He's got a cult-like status in this country. And, you know, most of the best coaches now, they'll only go and coach the international when they get a good job offer. I don't want to say that no one will ever do it, but it will be a job offer that they are interested in at that time. The better job offers are going to be in franchise cricket. So that's where I assume McCullum will go back to, and probably KKR. Neil says, Chappell, Border, Taylor, Waugh, Ponting, Clark, Smith, Payne, Cummins. Were they all good captains? Who's the best and who do you rate the least? Yeah, I wouldn't say any of them were bad captains. I think Chappell's a little bit before my time. Taylor was the one that probably was the most, Taylor was the one that would play the best on TV now. Like, I think if Mark Taylor came through now, he'd have like a proper fan base of just people like wanting to watch him. He did what Ben Soakes did without the sort of the hyper aspect. So he would make decisions not at the rate that Ben Stokes did, but the same sort of weird fielding plans, bowling changes and everything in a more sort of consistent, fun kind of way. So it always kept you interested. Most of the other captains, I would say most Australian captains throughout history are pretty, it's pretty lock and load. Like if you look at Waugh, Ponting, Clark, maybe Clark a little bit more fun, but Waugh, Ponting, Smith, Cummins, and you probably throw Payne in there as well. They're pretty much, this is our plan. This is what we're doing. The difference with Cummins maybe is that he does more research off the field, but that's also the generation he's in, right? But they come in with a decent plan. Like Waugh was just like, more slips, more slips, more slips. Edges eventually go through slips. And if that didn't work, Waugh didn't really have many other great plans. Ponting is a little bit like Joe Root as a captain. He really trusts only certain players. And so he just keeps throwing the ball back to them. And when that's not working, he would get a little bit lost. But yeah, if you're asking who the best captain, I suppose from a tactical point of view is, it's Taylor. But if you're looking for one who absolutely changed the way that Australian cricket was forever, it would be Border, who, I don't want to say brought in the professionalism, because obviously Bob Simpson was very much involved with that as well. But it was the two of them in combination that turned cricket into Australian cricket into the machine that went on to dominate the last 20 or 30 years through professionalism as much as anything else. Will says, am I crazy to think the Baz ball never really worked without Johnny Bairstow on top form? No, I don't think that's quite right. I mean, Bairstow obviously was a big part of it. But they were much better at dismissing teams as well under that. The threat of it, you know, the shock and awe nature of it worked as well. But yeah, Bairstow played a big part in it. But I don't think, like, Bairstow leaves and doesn't Harry Brook come into that spot? Like, he's done pretty well. So I don't think it's just a best. It's not Bairstow or bust, baseball. There's a lot of bees in that. Mob says, professionalism, team culture, and problem-solving in New Zealand cricket is regularly praised, and yet those benefits do not seem to have flowed to New Zealand women's game, barring the crapshoot of winning a T20 World Cup after losing 13 on the trot. Why not? The women's game was really unprofessional. So you can read about it in my book, But like one of the reasons Susie Bates got so good is because she played cricket and basketball, and she sort of trained a lot with the men, that she kind of became a professional at a time where there wasn't that there. So if you look at what's happened within the last 20 years of the men's team, and it is really the last 20 years, right? Is it 2003, Ross Taylor makes his debut in first class cricket. That's the year they go professional. The women's team has not been professional for most of that time. Late adopters, there's not a lot of money there. So I think if you're going to see that sort of professionalism, team culture side of things, that's probably going to happen in the next 10 to 15 years would be my guess based on the way these patterns work. So then you have to assume everything else stays the same. Problem solving, I actually think for New Zealand cricket, Susie Bates is probably one of the most instinctive captains I've ever seen on a cricket field. Her way of looking through things is incredible. But if you're doing that with a bunch of people who are not, like, don't have a lot of time, there doesn't seem to be the same talent level. So I don't know what percentage of the population play when it comes to women compared to men. I can only go on my background. In Melbourne, it felt like even in the 90s, there was more and more women playing all the time. I remember the first time that a bunch of women started who previously had done food and drinks and scoring at our club, left to go and play in a women's team. The next club I went to had a junior women's team and a senior women's team. So it felt like women were coming to cricket. I don't know if the same amount of numbers has happened in New Zealand. And even being in England, I feel like I don't see that side of things as much either. So maybe that's a sort of, I don't want to say a hidden, but like you do need a big part of the population to kind of take it up. And that felt like there was a couple of moments as Belinda Clark's runs in Australia, not in Australia, but for Australia. And there was Zoe Goss in the other game. There's a couple of moments that are like genuinely talked about by cricket fans. And there felt like there was a swell happening in the 90s. From the outside, I haven't seen that in New Zealand. So I don't know if that plays a part, because eventually what it comes down to is, the more people you have, the more talent you can find, and then you can put them into the professional system, but they didn't always have that either. Aris says, what is the best English test team of all time? 09 to 13 or the 50s team? Isn't there a team, Aris, from like the mid 50s to the early 60s, I want to say? I have written about this before, but I'd have to go back and check the exact years. But there is a section where there's just a brilliant England team. That would be what, Truman, I suppose Tyson would have been around. I'm trying to think of who their spinners would have been. Laker, was Locke have been around as well? And then just a plethora of they had so many good bats, they didn't even know how to use them all, right? They had guys like Bailey and D'Oliveira, although D'Oliveira might be a little bit later, I suppose. But they had guys like Bailey. I'm missing someone else. There's another all-rounder as well who gave them flexibility. I have looked at it before. I ranked like the five greatest test teams of all time. I think it was just for a Twitter post. I don't even know if I did an article on it in the end. But I actually spent ages on it, weirdly. Actually, it was for an article on how good South Africa was when that sort of a team broke up. And I was trying to put that into context of where they were. And I think I had them fourth or fifth. But yeah, there was an era there. I'd say that was better than the 09-13, at least in part because I think that was a much longer era. But the 09-13 would probably be the second one that I would have up there. And then, it depends on also how you feel about some of the earlier teams as well. Does Root taking the captaincy, obviously, if it happens, severely diminish his chances of going past Sachin? Feels like it ends with his retirement. It's a fascinating one. Look, he's not... Him just going about batting is when he's at his best. Him going about batting and thinking about captaincy and everything else does not work as well for him. There's no real denying that in his batting average. He averages about 46 when he's captain and about 53 or something when he's not. And considering that for a lot of the time he was captain, he was always or also in his peak batting age, I just don't know how you make the argument that it hasn't affected him. As you say, let's say he does it for 20 test matches and it's awful and he hates it again. Does he lose his love? Does he lose his interest? Does he want to keep playing? I think these are all very valid questions. I don't know if I have an answer to that, but if you're asking if it makes it less likely that he passes Sachin, I'd say yes. I think that's very fair. We will be back in a few moments after a word from our sponsor, which is me.
Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN.
Ian says, if Mitch Santner was English, what role does he have in the test team? Captain. That's fascinating. If he was English. I don't know. He still doesn't take a lot of wickets, does he? So I'm not sure. I don't know how the team would feel confident with him. I mean, I think they would like his all-round ability. He's such a late bloomer. I think, would he have even played white ball cricket as much with Moeen Ali around and his batting and him spinning it the same way as Adil Rashid? Kind of feel if Mitch Santner was English, he wouldn't play at all. He wouldn't have played much, maybe is the better way of putting it. Ali says, increasingly it seems that only the big three are holding the all-time record since they play the most amount of cricket. Hard to fathom that Stuart Broad has twice as many wickets as Kemal Roach. How to make sense of these stats as the rest of the non-big three world? Yeah, I think we just have to keep pointing out the that counting stats is just one way of doing things. You know, when we did the book, you know, and we were looking at these things, the old players don't have the counting stats, right? But what they do have sometimes is more longevity, right? Some of their careers are, you know, 15, 17, 18 years. And it's like, well, isn't that worth something more than, because you could play 100 tests as a, Australian English player, I would assume Indian as well, but certainly as an Australian Indian player, without getting injured in a 10-year period. Whereas it's going to take you 14 or 15 years with many other countries. So a 14 or 15-year career is more important to your country than a 10-year career, right? No matter how many test matches you play. I respect people like Stuart Broad in part just because of the amount of, it's hard to take a test wicket. It's hard to keep coming back day after day. Like those guys get it, but there's no doubt about that. But Kemal Roach is a fantastic bowler as well, right? And look, I don't think it's just the amount of test matches that the West Indies play. So what, he's ended up with 89 test matches, an average of 26.83. But in the middle of that, he had the car accident. So I'm trying to think of how many tests, because he had to redo his bowling a little bit too. So where are we? 10, 11, 12, 13. Yeah, it's probably 1 year, isn't it? He's got a fascinating record. I remember when I first saw him, I was commentating for Test Match Sofa at the time. And I was like, you know, this could be the next great bowler. Like this is the guy. I really think he could be one of the best bowlers in the world. You look at his overall record and that certainly stood up. It hasn't probably, I think there are ways of looking at his record, you know, the up and down nature of it. He's very much a hometown bowler. Right? Like he really, I don't know what his best record is away from the West Indies. So he's got 300 wickets, 200 of them are at home. And he's got 32 wickets in Australia and New Zealand at 43. 27 wickets in the UK at 33. And not too bad when he's played in South Africa and Zimbabwe. So there are, the point is that his record is weird beyond that. But yeah, if you just look at one metric, then obviously the players who play the most games are going to have that metric, right? Like you see it a lot. So Stuart Broad's fascinating for me because he played so many test matches that when you're doing a cutoff for runs, right, you know, to look at batters' records, he almost always comes up in it. So I think it's him and Warner, the two that come up in it, because they just played so many test matches that even though they didn't need, you know, they could both hold a bat, you know, they end up with this ridiculously higher overall total. And you're like, well, that's just from the sheer number of games. So yeah, there's always more than one metric. I think anyone who just looks at one metric, you're limiting what cricket is down to a single number. And averages are great, and overall wicket tally and runs tallies, they're all really good things, but they're one of like 10 or 12 numbers if you're being realistic, right? Hurt says, although Mitchell was the backbone of New Zealand's response in the third test, Ratchan played some eye-catching classical shots that were beautiful to watch. Is it a stretch to say that Ratchan is the most pedigreed batter, ceiling priced in to come out of New Zealand since Kane? I mean, everyone's kind of said that. The thing with Ratchan is he came out, he played really good to start with, everyone got very excited, and then there's been a bit of a regression. I think I commentated on at least one of his hundreds. I've commentated one, and I've seen him bat quite a bit. I thought the innings at Trent Bridge, I'm trying to remember, was probably the best I've ever seen him bat. And I thought he was really good at the Oval too, but I thought the Trent Bridge one was the best I've seen him bat. I think he has, Daryl Mitchell is like a senior player. You can't compare the two of them. One is a stopgap player who's going to play for you for at least 7 or 8 years if everything goes right. And the other one is a generational talent. Like, no one has thought that Mitchell was the generational talent because he comes into the team at 28. Josh says, Blundell justifiably received a lot of credit for his ability to keep up the stumps where makeshift keepers would struggle. If some teams baseball shuffle more than others, could it be reasonable to have different keepers, keeping seals versus batting seals for different series, depending on the shuffletude of the opposition? Yeah, it's not just about the shuffle. It's, you know, the Pakistani players and just batting out of their crease as well, right? Like, and I say them as a group. There are lots of players around the world who've done this. Joe Root doesn't really shuffle all that much either. He quite often bats out of his crease. So yes, I do think, you know, I'm hoping that Blundell and Carey have changed wicketkeeping again. We needed I did a huge piece a few years ago called Point Fielders with Gloves On. And we knew from that time, well, I should say I wrote at that time that we needed like an outlier. I was saying at the moment, at that time, player, but maybe it was an outlier event to change because we know that wicketkeeping is undervalued. So something had to happen to revalue it, to bring it back. And I think that has definitely happened now. Chris says, when players are up on a test match balcony with laptops and iPads in front of them, what are they usually looking at? I assume it's Combox daily match analysis. They don't know what to do better. It's just us. Generally, when they're looking at that stuff, it will be footage. You can see it in the Football World Cup, right? When they're about to go out and play in a penalty shootout, the players will quite often huddle around a screen. Was it the Australia Egypt game, I think, where you just saw the Egyptian team huddling around a screen and looking at random clips of games, which was obviously set up for, you know, just such a thing. I think Australia switched their goalkeeper, right? But yeah, you look at that, you might be looking at your own technique, you might be looking at someone else's and everything else. I wouldn't have thought it would have been anything else. The analyst, I've had mixed reports on this. When I was an analyst, I was told that you couldn't go on the internet. I might have the term wrong, but there's like a whitelisting thing that allows you access to the internet, but just on a very narrow basis that I think some modern international analysts have. I need to talk to, you know, Nathan or Freddie would know that better than I would, but I'm not 100% sure. But yeah, I think there is an element of like sometimes you have some access to the internet, but the players don't have access to the internet at all, except for the fact that they do have an iPad in front of them and all they have to do is take the airplane mode off it. The illusion of security. Anyway, Satchmo says, how do England prepare for the 2027 summer if they don't know Stokes will be available? They'll have to field at least one player this winter whose place could be filled by Stokes if he came back. Yeah, but that would be the same if they have an injury, Satchmo, really, wouldn't it? I mean, I understand this is a worse situation, but that's a fairly common thing for an international team to do. Like, Australia has a series against India and India coming up, and they don't know if their spinner will be back or will ever bowl again for them, right? So that between then, they, you know, they're going to have to try some other spinners and see how they go. But those spinners might also be yanked back out of the side if Nathan Lyon is suddenly fit. Like, that is what cricket teams are used to doing. It's not an ideal situation. I think you plan for the fact he's not going to come back. And if he comes back, that's a bonus. And you see if you still want him, which they probably will. PJ says, in a hypothetical fantasy world, which is his favorite, what would our cricket world look like if it copied baseball's farm system with minor leagues, rookie ball, AA, AAA, etc.? Alternatively, do we already have that in place with the IPL being Major League Baseball and everything else being the minors? No, because the minors is very specifically, you will own a bunch of teams and it is those teams' job to prepare your players for the international setup, right? That's not what county teams do. It's not what first-class teams do around the world, right? County, I would say more so than the others. But even in first-class situations, sometimes it's like those teams are still trying to win. And so I think we would have more clear role definition. It would be better for development and everything else if we had a baseball system. But there are also strengths to our system, I think, as well. You have to, at a certain point, you have to be relatively successful at the lower level, not just look like it will transfer to the top level. Like you're playing competitive games. I don't want to say that minors and AAA and AA are not competitive, but there are elements of people playing for spots rather than just playing to win games, I think, at times. So there are probably strengths and minuses in both. But the baseball one, if you're just as a development system, makes a lot more sense. Mob says, Jacob Duckerby was New Zealand men's cricketer of the year last year and the second highest annual wicket taker ever to Richard Hadlee. It's pretty high. He allies with the impeccable Matt Henry, the Goliath KG, and the terrifying Will O'Rourke. That's four paces. Suddenly there's no room for player of your series. And Nathan Smith. Oh yeah, we had this one before. Can you please talk about how you would manage the exact loads and assignments of New Zealand pace battery? Yeah, I think what we're assuming at this point is that everyone is fit and available. I could tell you that I would not be picking Blair Tickner again. I don't think he's a test match bowler. I don't really understand why they have him in any of their squads. I've seen him bowl enough times now. He's not very accurate. I don't know what his best ball is in test cricket. He seems, when he gets wickets, it's usually just because people are trying to hit him really hard. And considering he averages like mid-30s in first-class cricket, I would say that's just not the player. But with everyone else, you've got all these different options. I think you have to assume that one of them is going to be injured at any one time. And so it's very rare that Duffy or Smith would not be needed. I think Smith does something. I think Duffy is probably more similar to Henry. And I think Smith is fundamentally different, as I was speaking about earlier on the show. I think the match is probably better with Smith. He's still a genuine swing bowler in an era where there aren't that many, everyone else is bowling with a wobble ball. And he's not a similar bowler to Kyle Jameson, so there's no real overlap there. But I think this is the wrong way to think about it. The right way to think about it is we have five options going ahead. We can rest people. We're going to have injuries naturally anyway. Matt Henry is automatic. Maybe Kyle Jameson is all automatic. And then everyone else comes in and out depending on conditions and fitness and resting. And that's fine. And you're still going to, you know, rest Henry and Jameson as well. So I'm not one of these people who's like, how do you fit them all in? I'm like, they will all play because that's what happens with fast bowlers, right? It's very rare to have five fast bowlers and have them all be fit at the same time for more than a month. So you just keep them, and then the next test you work out, is this a Duffy pitch? Is this a Jameson pitch? Is this a Henry? Is Jameson redlining? Is Will O'Rourke redlining? and you play it that way. I think that's the way that I would do it. I think that you don't need to overcomplicate these things. When it comes down to it, the cricket will take care of itself. And having five options is better than having four anyway.
I once made a pair in a club game, which is almost impossible to do. But I've been obsessed with batting my entire life. And so I put that into my new book, The Art of Batting. Being that I'm not very good at that skill, I decided to talk to other people who were. So I hit up as many contacts as I could just to talk about batting. Rahul Dravid, Brian Lara, AB de Villiers, Kumar Sangakkara, Ross Taylor, Susie Bates, Nasser Hussain, Ian Chappell, and so many, many, many more. I wanted batters to talk about how they and their friends made runs, because that is the art of batting.
All right, we've got a few super chats come through, like from Walnut, who says, do you think keeper batters would exist if there was trust in doing selections well? Depicting keepers on their batting ability started as a ritual of accountability. Now, is an England wicketkeeper in the 1960s? Just trying to bring up his name. Yeah, Jim Parkes. So in 1964, England make a decision to bring in a guy called Jim Parkes. And they basically decide that Jim Parkes is a can bat. And that is the first real situation where we have someone who we know is not a frontline keeper. I think he did keep for Sussex, but I don't think anyone thought of him as like, he wasn't considered like in the best two or three keepers in the country. So even when you have Les Ames before that, or Farouk Engineer, even Clyde Walcott, I think all those guys, as far as I'm aware, were considered to be top of their class of keeping. They might not have always been considered to be number one, but they were close enough to number one, right? Jim Parkes is not that. So in 1964-ish, they bring him in and they basically say, we're going to pick you. From 1964 until 1985-ish, you see this general move towards batting averages of wicketkeepers slowly rising. And so again, what you have at that stage is, if there's ever even close to a tie, it always goes to the batting option. And then eventually, even when the batting keeper is maybe third or fourth, if they're much better than the others at batting, they start to come in. And it's because we can't quantify wicketkeeping, right? Counting byes doesn't really do it. We don't keep catching stats for some reason in cricket. You know, all these different things, we don't have any metrics that can help us with this. And so the only metric we have is batting. And so we slowly get that. And then in the 80s, Gunnar Gould, there's like two or three others who come into the team because they are thought to be good batters in the one ball team, white ball team. So again, England's done that. Jeffrey Dujon was picked over, is it Derek Murray or David Murray? There was lots of Murrays who were really good wicketkeepers in the West Indies. And they went with a genuine wicketkeeper, a genuine batting keeper. And then you just see teams keep making that decision over and over again. It feels like the Asian teams are probably the ones that are less likely to do it. And that's because keeping up the stumps is harder and, you know, can be cheated less, maybe is the best way of putting it. But even then we start to see that coming in. And I really just think it's because we have a metric that we can count with batting and we don't with wicketkeeping. Sameet says, I love the Kagiso KG, the test bowler chat. Does he mean the Kagiso one? I think that's the one I'm trying to remember. So what makes a fast bowler skilled? Is it the number of tools? Stain only had outswing, reverse and a bouncer. Fewer variations than Jimmy or Asif. Would you call Stain limited and yet the best flat pitch fast bowler? Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah, I think what we were saying with Rabada is his best ball is as close to the best ball of anyone of this generation and of all time, right? Joel Garner would be another guy you would just put in that thing of just like, you just need to bowl this ball over and over again and there's nothing anyone can do. Richard Hadlee would be another one, right? And in Richard Hadlee's case, he obviously had other skills and could go to them. And you would probably say in Garner and Rabada's case that they have a couple of other skills, but there's almost no reason with them bowling the other deliveries because their first ball is so good and is so hard to handle, right? And so you say Stain only had outswing, reverse, and a bouncer. That's three things he was elite at, right? That on his own as a bowler is very rare for any bowler to have three elite skills. I get your point with Steyn, but I think Steyn is more, one of the reasons Steyn is so good is, again, is because his natural ball is so devastating. So he's angling his natural ball in and it's skidding, and so you don't have much time. And so if it doesn't swing away, you've now got Bolden LBW in play. And if it does swing away, you've got wicketkeeper in and Corden in play. And so in some ways, Steyn is similar to that sort of Richard Hadlee, Kapil Dev type of bowler, right? But they can't reverse the ball. They don't have express pace and they don't have a killer bouncer. So even though he's not quite as skillful as those two other guys, he actually has multiple options available to him. Muhammad Asif or Jimmy Anderson, like Muhammad Asif could probably bowl everything. Even his bouncer was kind of handy because it had a weird steeple bounce off it, right? Maybe not so much with his Yorker, but he was so accurate with his Yorker. Those are the guys who are the guys with the biggest tool kit, right? But that doesn't mean that Muhammad Asif is a better bowler than Kagiso Rabada. One tool, if it's the right tool, might be the difference between you being a good bowler and a great bowler. There are, going first class cricket, there are so many guys who have multiple tools, but they don't have one thing that works every single delivery in test match cricket, right? How many spinners can bowl multiple deliveries, but their stock ball doesn't put any pressure on you, right? But yeah, so no, I wouldn't call Steyn limited because I think he had multiple options. I think I would say probably Morne Morkel was limited. We talked about Garner, Rabada. I'd probably say Waqar Yunus was a little bit limited. Trying to think of others through history that would be like that. Nathan Lyon is a limited bowler, right? I would probably put him in that situation. He doesn't have I remember comparing him to Graham Swann one day, and I said, Nathan Lyon has a lot of the same skills that Graham Swann has, but Graham Swann has more variety in ways he can get you out. Whereas Nathan Lyon's trying to get you out pretty much the same way over and over and over again, right? And so that's what we're really talking about there. I don't remember where the Rabada chat was, though. Was that on TalkSport, maybe? Jessica coming in again. In fact, all the super chats so far have been really, really generous. So thank you to everyone. Have I not done a wagon wheel in a while? Samit says, also explain KG the batter. Samit's double tapping on KG. How could someone with the batting ability of a number 11 have the stance, balance, and elegance of a classical number 3? Yeah, so I think sometimes we get a little bit confused. I think he's got better batting ability than a number 11, right? I think that if Kagiso Rabada played club cricket, he would be probably a player who looks pretty good but doesn't have a high batting average. So maybe he averages 25 in club cricket or something along those lines. Because he can play shots in an aesthetically pleasing way. And so everyone thinks he can bat, but there's a little bit of robot the way he bats. He just plays the same, like he will play those beautiful like cover drives, right? But he also plays them to balls that you should not be playing them to. And so I've played with lots of guys like Kagiso Rabada before who are generally way up the order higher than everyone else, while the guys who actually make runs are sitting there going, why do they keep picking this guy ahead of me? So he looks like he can make runs, but he can't make runs is actually not that confusing a thing. I think if you look in the history of cricket, we've promoted a lot of guys like that before. Puro the Pro says, great to finally catch you live again. When will Match Factor expected runs be mainstream? The more I delve, it's almost unfair that Williamson had such a high average, mainly by home record versus poorer teams. Latham too. Yeah, a lot of New Zealanders, which we're going to do a video on during the series, but we never quite got it out. I don't know with Match Factor. Expected runs, I don't know if there's a really good metric for expected runs in like test cricket. But yeah, Match Factor, era factor, median score, home versus away average, or home versus away, any of those other things I've just said, I think are all really, really good things in looking at cricketers. we at Combox are, you know, probably not too far away from hopefully having more metrics available. I think the way that I look at it is, I remember actually, like, you know, I got into this quite late compared to some of the other analysts. But when I got into it, the one thing I could never understand is when I followed, so I got in through basketball, but also I did a lot of work in football and baseball, you know, to try and work out all the different methods, what might work best for cricket, right? And when I did that, what I realized is no one else is really like over-indexing on like one stat, like in the community. Sometimes the TV companies and the media people latch onto them, but in the community, everyone's quite understanding of, like, you know, there's a really good stat that John Hollinger has in basketball, which is called PER, which is player efficiency rating. And it basically can go through box scores, I think, throughout the history of basketball and kind of tell you if this person is a productive player on the measurable stats, right? There's holes in the system, but it tells you if this player is, you know, a productive, efficient player. It's got obviously flaws in it. But when you use that, and then you use that compared to maybe LeBron method or, you know, all these different, you know, their offense rating, their defense rating, whatever, you start to get a bit of a picture of who this player is. If you just looked at PER, it wouldn't make any sense. If you just looked at match factor, I don't think it would make any sense either. So you need to be able to use these. And when I came to cricket, everyone was like treating any new number that came out like it had to be like, and I see this now sometimes where people are like, you know, match factor is flawed. I'm like, yeah, we know. Like, they're all flawed. But what we're trying to do is come up with, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 different methods to be able to look at this. It gives us a better idea of where the truth actually sits. And I think in a sport like cricket, you can't have one number. What you need is multiple numbers. And so it's not so much that I would want a situation where we end up with one number. What we are really looking at is allowing cricket fans to explore the numbers that they want from here on in, understanding the strengths and weaknesses. I don't know if we'll be able to do it on Combox on the app specifically, but what I really want to be able to do in the future is be like, okay, so here's the app. If you want more information, we have this over here and you can find out about each one of those stats, which I think we have on our on Good Areas already for some of them. And then what we want to be able to do is take it to a step further of like, here's the flaws in this one. Here's the reason why it works, et cetera, et cetera. Puro again says, remember your I Am Zadran on 2 Men Out show of Crick Info results during the 2015 World Cup today. Yeah, it's really sad. I remember when I first heard that Shapo Zadran was ill. I did a short video about it earlier, but he's one of two cricketers I've ever taken a selfie with, although I cannot find a selfie. I'm pretty sure it's on my Instagram, but I couldn't find it. And I just loved him. I loved his energy and his passion, his hair, his action. He was just a really enjoyable person. He didn't speak particularly good English, but I chatted to him a little bit off the record. I remember seeing him in the Wacker Nets. He was one of my favorite cricketers of that era. I can't remember what piece I was writing, but I don't think it was about him. But like, I found this video of him dancing at like a wedding or something. It's just, he did everything with joy. I only met him briefly, so maybe he wasn't like that in other ways. But every time I saw him on a camera or I spent any time around him, he just seemed to have a lot of joy and passion and love in him. And, you know, from that perspective, you know, if you're, when someone like that disappears, you feel like the world is a little bit worse, a little, you know, than it was before. Afghanistan's going to have better cricketers than him coming through, obviously. But the reason that we talk about history and we talk about everything that we do on Good Areas and Combox in general is because Afghanistan cricket is also built on the back of people like Shapo Zadran, right? And I don't think we should ever forget someone like that. He certainly was a fantastic player, a fantastic person to watch. And, you know, hopefully people like us will remember him for a very, very long time. Thoughts and, you know, go out to his family in this time. And the Afghanistani cricket community, which is obviously a very small knit community as well. Anyway, that is me done on the Wagon Wheel for today. Thank you very much for all of those very generous super chats today, but also the Patreons as well. But everyone who was here on the live, you all make a difference to the algorithm, to the algorithm of my heart. We'll see you again next time.
Thank you for listening to this podcast on the Combox Network. There is an ad-free version of this you can find by supporting us on Patreon at Good Areas Podcast. You can also access our Discord channel there. Please like, subscribe, and rate this show. Every one of these helps us. If there was a guest on a show, you can find their links in the show notes. Huge thanks to Ruckshit, Ishit, and everyone else who helps us get our content out there. If you want to know more about us, head to combox.tv.
If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.